Good evening and welcome. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I'd like to welcome all of you to our third season of the Michigan Writers Series. This series, hosted by the MSU Libraries, is intended to bring prominent Michigan writers to the libraries, to the campus, for public readings and discussion, and I'm delighted to see so many people out tonight to hear our three readers this evening. As usual with the Michigan Writers Series, each of our readings, and we've been doing this now since the winter of 1999, each of our readings is recorded and put up on the internet. And so if you go to the homepage of the MSU Libraries, that's www.lib.msu.edu, and find the Vincent Voice Library homepage, you'll be able to hear past readings as well as this reading. So not only do you have the delightful experience of listening to it live tonight, but at some time in the near future, the entire world will be able to listen to our readings tonight, as they have for all the other readings since 1999. As I mentioned, we do have a wonderful group, not one, not two, but three prominent Michigan writers, all here from the Lansing area and obviously all with a wonderful following. And what I'd like to do is introduce them individually to you. Each one will read for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then at the end, all three of them will be available to take questions from the audience. Our first reader tonight is Kathleen Levy, who has worked in newspaper reporting and editing since 1985 at papers including the Livingston County Press, the Fremont, Ohio News Messenger, the Port Huron Times Herald, and of course the Lansing State Journal. She is a graduate of the University of Michigan and earned her MFA in creative writing at Western Michigan University. Ms. Levy's freelance work has been published in Michigan Alumnus magazine and in the book Peninsula, Essays and Memoirs from Michigan, which was just recently published by the Michigan State University Press and has found great success. I'd like to welcome, and will you please join me in welcoming, Kathleen Levy.
Hi, everybody. It's approximately this time of the speaking that I always notice that my hair is sticking out and I have a spot on my sweater, so don't pay attention to those things. I have two things that I'm going to read for you tonight. And the first one is, since I was lucky enough to be a part of the Peninsula book, I have been thinking a lot about place. And one of the places that I've been thinking about is my hometown of Pinckney, Michigan, which some of you may be familiar with it. It's in Livingston County, north of Ann Arbor. Used to be a little town all by itself, and now is sort of not, becoming suburban pretty quickly. So I'm working on a kind of a longer piece that ruminates a little bit on that kind of change, and I'm going to read you the first part of that, and then I'll just read one of my columns for you. So the only title this has so far is Pinckney. When I was still in college, I got a news reporting internship at a chain of weekly newspapers in western Oakland County. I was assigned to work for the Novi Walled Lake News. That summer, I wrote a number of stories connected with the opening of the new Sheraton Hotel, which sat surrounded by empty fields across from 12 Oaks Mall. 12 Oaks had been open for several years and was likewise surrounded by open fields. I covered battles between developers and zoning boards and wrote stories about people who didn't like to sit on decks of their state-of-the-art homes and smell manure wafting over from the dairy farm that had been there for generations. I even wrote a story about a woman who shot woodchucks from her porch within view of the mall. The fingers of suburbia were reaching out and carving great claw marks into Novi's rural landscape. As I went about my reporting work, I felt sorry for the people of Novi, and I also felt a little smug. My hometown, Pinckney, was 35 miles farther from Detroit, 35 miles safer from being swallowed. Now, I am a seasoned newspaper reporter and editor. I live in East Lansing and I visit Pinckney often. Now I look around my old hometown and see fake Tudors and Nouveau Victorians with plastic gingerbread and golf courses and gated communities with yearly association fees. I can tell you with distress that it takes about 15 years for suburbia to travel 35 miles. Each time I drive home, whether I take M36 or Grand River Avenue or I-96, I see new for sale signs among the corn stubble, new 2x4 skeletons sheathed in particle board, new signs announcing exclusive communities and new homes from the 160s. They have unusual names like Hometown Village, What does that mean? The pace is much faster than the pace of the glaciers that shape the southeast corner of Livingston County into a place that is so desirable that newcomers will drive 70 miles each way to work. The glaciers created small hills, gently rolling fields, meandering, clear-flowing streams, wide marshlands, and dozens of lakes. Just south of Pinckney is an expansive tree-covered hill known as Peach Mountain, where the French explorer La Salle once camped. The settlers who incorporated the village in the 1830s built a grist mill and created a downtown with a few wooden stores where they bought the things that they could not make themselves. Eventually, they built a hotel and an opera house, too, and raised themselves above the street-level dirt by building a boardwalk. The people of Pinckney in the 1830s were my ancestors, who left the subdivided fields of Ireland six generations ago looking for something better. In Pinckney, they found it. I grew up in a house on Putnam Street, sold to my grandfather for $2,000 in 1922. It is the house where my father grew up and where I shared the front upstairs bedroom with my sister. My grandmother snapped photos of the village's downtown and her friends and my grandfather on the front porch. She developed and printed them herself and preserved them in thick black albums that now smell like history. When I was a young child, Pinckney was not that different than the Pinckney of my father's childhood. We had a general store and two small groceries, but no supermarket. We had a doctor, elderly, no dentist. There was one Catholic church, a handful of Protestant churches, a village square, a tiny library. But change was coming, fast. Riot-scarred Detroit lay an hour to the east. Families who had already left the city in droves now found their segregated suburban lives in peril. Laws affecting Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties meant their children would again find themselves attending the same schools as black children. Families who could afford to leave were scared. They fled to the closest county that wasn't affected by the rules, Livingston. For a period of time during the 1970s, Livingston County was the fastest growing county in the nation. Yes, the nation. Eager land developers whacked up dozens of the old farms into 10.01 and 5.01 acre parcels, where families from Westland and Allen Park and Livonia built split-level houses with walkout basements into the sides of rolling hills. The same things happened in Brighton and Hamburg Township to the east, and to Howell and Hartland in the north. To the 1,000 residents of the village and the several thousand who lived in the surrounding township, the influx was horrifying and terribly, terribly unfair. It was a better life for them, and hell on earth for us. The rural school districts were ill-prepared to handle new students. Cranes swung portable classrooms into place at Pinckney and Hamburg elementary schools and set up a row of the aluminum-sided cubes on an asphalt strip behind the high school. Elementary and middle school students were split into morning and afternoon shifts, with one group attending from about 7:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. and the other from 1 to 6 p.m. Desks were shared, lockers were shared, the locked baskets that stored gym uniforms were shared. During the 1980s, Western Oakland County and Eastern Livingston County continued to expand. Large tracts of undeveloped land like the old Burroughs Farms Resort property near Brighton were developed into exclusive communities. The little party store at a country intersection near that development quadrupled in size and started selling designer beer and complete takeout meals. Inevitably, the exclusive communities spread west, engulfing Old Pinckney and obliterating it. What you need is a good strip mall, the newcomers say, parking their cars in driveways carved from fields. They live in places called Whispering Pines and Putnam Meadows, built around golf courses. They pay prices exceeding $300,000 for homes in a place called Moon Shadows, which backs up to Rush Lake, so named because it is shallow and weedy. They are happy they have lakefront property. All around Portage Lake, the cottages built by the settlers of the 1920s are being remodeled and jacked up into three-story towers that cost $250,000 or more. Only a couple of vacant lots or unwinterized cottages remain. Even they went on the market last year for $160,000. My grandfather made a good investment. The value of his pretty house in town with the wraparound porch is more than 50 times what he paid for it. Even the claustrophobic angular houses in the ominously named Village Edge subdivision are advertised at affordable prices of $120,000 and up. Sure, a few patches of early Pinckney remain. Half of Silver Lake is state park property and thus undeveloped. But the miles of hilly and wooded trails, once the quiet domain of hikers, have been taken over and eroded by the spinning, knobby tires of mountain bikers who often are less than willing to share the paths with people on foot. Peach Mountain, where LaSalle camped, is owned by the University of Michigan and remains undeveloped except for a radio telescope at its summit. At the corner of M36 and Farley Road, just a mile from a new state-of-the-art elementary school, sits the old Hicks School, a one-room schoolhouse lovingly maintained by the septuagenarian members of the Historical Society. Pinckney's quaint downtown with its village square and gazebo thrives, although specialty stores like a bike shop and an upscale restaurant have replaced the businesses that once offered farmers store-bought necessities. These days, the newcomers of the 60s and 70s have begun to grumble about the traffic and the crowding and the noise on their once rural roads. This gives the natives an opportunity to say, "How do you think we felt?" Well, that's all I'm going to do for you tonight from that piece of work. I have a little bit more of that written, but I'm still kind of working on where that's going. But hopefully there are some people who can kind of relate to that situation. The other thing that I am going to read for you tonight is a newspaper column that I wrote a little bit earlier this year. And this one kind of also, I kind of got hung up on history and time, and I'm not sure what that's about, but this one is about time and speed and clocks, and it won't take long. I live in a house where every clock is digital or decorative. There's a flashing green clock on the microwave oven, a flashing amber one in the TV. The others are powered by AA batteries hidden behind fake antique faces or decorative boxes. They all sweep or change or roll over silently, moving forward without a tick or a tock. When they stop, they merely stop. There's never a clunk or a groan or the twang of a spring letting go. I barely glance at these clocks as I rush from one room to another, getting ready to run to my car. It has its own clock, little green numbers in the dashboard. I am never satisfied with the way that time passes inside of them. My sister, on the other hand, spends time with her time. Once a week, she stands in front of the tall, chiming grandfather clock and lifts each of its three weights with one hand while pulling the chain that suspends it with her other. Bit by bit over the course of the week, the weights will do their job, pulling each chain ever so slowly around a separate gear, driving the mechanisms that make the clock tick and the hands turn and the chimes ring at each quarter hour. Once a week, she stands in front of the old mantel clock and winds it. Insert the key into the left side of the face. Turn it 8 times clockwise. Insert the key into the right side 8 times counterclockwise. Tip the clock ever so slightly to get the pendulum moving. The result? A week's worth of soothing ticks and tocks with chimes on the hour and the half hour. Recently, she just got another clock back from the man who repairs these functioning antiques. She carries them to him packed carefully into boxes. They talk together about things such as bushings and springs and pendulums, things that make me ashamed of my quartz cells and my AA batteries. The brass weights on the anniversary clock first spin one way, then the other. The whole mechanism rests under a glass dome. The clock offers not only the time, but a display of what appears to be perpetual motion. My sister told me this weekend that she just took another clock to her man. My grandmother bought the clock at an estate sale in the 1930s, and Linda just found it in the attic. It has never worked since she bought it. It is ornate. It has a marble top and pillars at either side, and is decorated with heads of the Roman god Mercury. She asked him, "Was it worth fixing?" He said, "It is the real thing, Seth Thomas, worth about $450. A bona fide classic timekeeper." Now, some people would call it work, winding these clocks, caring for these clocks. Some people would call it crazy, paying heavy prices and waiting for months for the man to practice his dying art and keep them running. I would call it calming. Once, there was a world of ticks and tocks and chimes, and things moved at a more bearable pace. Once, there was a world where people had time to pull out a pocket watch, open it, and consult it instead of just glancing at their wrist or into the corner of their computer screen. The ticks and tocks remind us each second that it isn't time that is running too fast, it's us. Thank you.
Sheila Schimpf has been the weekly columnist at the Lansing State Journal since 1987. Before coming to Lansing, she wrote for the Bergen Record in Hackensack, New Jersey. Ms. Schimpf earned a bachelor's degree in journalism from the University of Detroit and a master's degree in journalism from MSU. She's a former adjunct faculty member at MSU and has authored several unpublished children's books. Please welcome Sheila Schimpf.
Hello. It's cross-country season for lucky families who have someone on the cross-country team. So I thought that I would start by reading a column that I wrote 4 years ago now about my son who ran cross-country. He's now at the University of Michigan, and he does not run cross-country anymore. And I think maybe I miss it more than he does. On a cool, overcast Saturday morning, the cross-country runners lined up on the fields of Davisburg. Seven runners from about 20 schools formed a long, thin, colorful line. In reds, blues, greens, purples, and bright oranges, the boys in men's bodies sprinted out and back to the starting line, waiting for the gun to start the regional competition. The junior varsity runner from our house waited, bag in hand, to collect the warm-ups when they were discarded. The first alternate, he would not be running this day. It was a mixed blessing. He had run only 2 days before in the final JV meet, and Davisburg had a reputation as a slow, hard course. Still, after making the trip and warming up, it seemed an unfinished end to the season somehow. It had been a good year. He cut 2 minutes off his time, bettering his goal. Once, he even beat his older brother, who stumbled across the line with a cramp. The younger brother finally had established himself. Irrefutable proof of that came when his older brother started to ask his times. The gunshot sounded, and the varsity runners, including our oldest son, were off, disappearing almost immediately from sight. This is the part that is so hard for the uninitiated. For several minutes, sometimes five, the runners are gone from view. Out there on the 3 mile course, they are laboring mightily, jockeying for position, calling on their strength, all the while invisible to the crowd. In this race, they came back into view just before the 1 mile mark. Our varsity runner was doing well in his typical position, about fifth on the East Lansing team. He had been training 5 days a week since the hot, sweaty days of summer. A senior with 4 years' experience, he knew the importance of persistence. Cross country is not forgiving. You can't take 2 weeks off in August or September and expect to finish in the top five. He knew how to warm up, how to stretch, what shoes to wear. He knew how to run in the rain, how to work through a jam, how to avoid getting spiked. He had strategy. He had confidence. He knew who he was. That is what cross country can do. When he gets to be 25 or 45 or 65, inside, a part of him still will be that cross country runner who took the course Saturday, young, strong, healthy, and able. I scuttled across a brown field to catch a quick glimpse before they disappeared into the woods. When they emerged, he was running with another East Lansing guy. I had lost track of his place. He was in the pack, running well. It was not too hot, not too windy, and not raining. He disappeared again, and I hurried to the finish line. When he came into view, the look on his face was terrible. The exertion was painful to watch. He was straining mightily, pushing himself. I could see why. He was third on the East Lansing team, battling an Okemos runner when he crossed the finish line for the last time. It was the end of his career. He didn't need this race to earn a varsity letter. He had no hope of going on to the state competition. He could have laid back and coasted. That was also true for the majority of runners on the course. They were running against themselves, against the clock, against long-term competitors on their own team. It was not a course that would improve their personal records. In the end, no one will engrave their times on a plaque. No flags will fly in a field house. They go home, wash their uniforms, and turn them in for the last time. They make plans for a banquet where they will get a letter and a mock award. They will put a few pictures in a frame on their desk when they get to college. They will tell party stories of the different courses, sandy, rocky, hilly, wet. They will relive the tension of the starting line, the exhaustion of the finish line, and the afterglow that starts before the cool-down run. And they will know when they are 25 or 45 or 65 that they ran the race of their lives the last time out, when it didn't count, except to themselves. Now, that would be what I do for a living, okay? And I like it very much. But in my spare time at home, when no one is publishing it, I write children's stories. I read children's stories when I was little, and I read them out loud to my children when they were growing up. So I've tried my hand at this one, and it's come back from many publishers with long letters. Some of them are personal letters telling me what's wrong with this story. But I can't help it. I still like this story. So I'm going to read it to you, okay? It's called Midnight in the Kitchen with Mozart. Take a nap, Mother said to Delaney Rose. Why? Delaney Rose asked. She was way too old to take naps. She was 8. Agnes Ann is coming tonight, Mother said. Nobody in the world was like Delaney Rose's Aunt Agnes Ann. At least no other grown-ups. She chewed gum, wore sandals, ate ice cream, and stopped at the park on her way home from anywhere. She could never sit still. She was always looking for something fun to do, like cross-country skiing or rollerblading, and somebody fun to do it with her. Aunt Agnes Ann frustrated Delaney Rose's mother, and it made Delaney Rose giggle. Just when her mother had settled onto the couch with a catalog to read and a cup of tea, her aunt would think of something they just had to do right away, something fun. Delaney Rose's mother would sigh deeply and say, "Oh, honestly, Agnes Ann, why can't you just be serious?" That's the same thing her mother would say to Delaney Rose when Delaney Rose wanted to paint her toenails green or comb her wet hair straight up or stay home from school on a warm, sunny day. And it was just the beginning of what she would say when Delaney Rose wanted to eat dessert first, walk backward, or stay up all night. Aunt Agnes Ann stayed up all night. She worked nights in the newborn nursery at the hospital. The stories she told about the hospital were better than the stories in books. When Aunt Agnes Ann had a day off, it was really a night. So Delaney Rose went to bed. She wanted to be awake when Aunt Agnes Ann came. Agnes Ann came very late. Delaney Rose's father and her baby brother had already gone to bed. "Now, Kate," Aunt Agnes Ann said to Mother, "you run along to bed. Delaney Rose and I have a few things to do." Mother looked a little uncertain about leaving her sister in charge. Aunt Agnes Ann winked at Delaney Rose and pushed her sister toward the stairs. Delaney Rose didn't have the foggiest idea what they were going to do, but she could hardly wait to get started. "Now," Agnes Ann said as soon as they were alone, "the first thing to do is turn off all the lights." Delaney Rose jumped up. She loved the dark. Aunt Agnes Ann dug through her huge canvas tote bag while Delaney Rose turned off all the lights. Aunt Agnes Ann placed 10 candles around the kitchen and lit them. Some were fat and some were short. Some were white and some were red. The kitchen glowed. Now we're going to get cooking, Aunt Agnes Ann said. Delaney Rose looked at the clock. It was almost midnight. It was way past her bedtime. She grinned. What are we cooking? She said, wide awake and ready. Brownies, Aunt Agnes Ann said. Tomorrow is Mozart's birthday. But, Aunt Agnes Ann, Delaney Rose said, isn't he dead? Very, Aunt Agnes Ann said. You would be too if you were born in 1756. Aunt Agnes Ann looked at Delaney Rose, checking her from top to bottom to see if she were still alive. But the music he wrote is a different matter. It's still alive. We play it in the nursery all night long. The babies love him. We always have a party in the nursery to celebrate January 27th, and it's my turn to bring the brownies. She rummaged around in her canvas bag again. This time she came up with cocoa powder, vanilla, and sugar. We need flour and 2 brownie pans, Aunt Agnes Ann said. Delaney Rose opened the cupboard doors. Suddenly, Aunt Agnes Ann pulled a cassette tape from her bag. Got a tape player, she said. Delaney Rose flew up the stairs to get the tape player in her bedroom. Her father was snoring gently. She was careful not to trip on the stuffed animals in the middle of her room, still tied to their rocket ship on their way to the moon. I can't play with you guys now, she whispered. When Delaney Rose got back to the kitchen, it was cozy yellow in the candlelight. Aunt Agnes Ann had lined up the brownie things next to a big bowl, but she stopped to pop the tape into Delaney Rose's tape player. Mozart, she winked again. She measured cocoa and sugar into the bowl. Care to dance? She grabbed Delaney Rose and they swooped around the kitchen, making the candles flicker. I do love good music, Aunt Agnes Ann said, laughing. She measured the vanilla and the flour into the bowl. Stir a little, will you? Delaney Rose stirred while Aunt Agnes Ann danced. We forgot to grease the pans, Aunt Agnes said, energetically rubbing margarine on the bottom of the pans. I think we forgot something else, Delaney Rose said, looking at the dry lump of dough in the bowl. Liquid, Aunt Agnes Ann exclaimed, measuring first water, then oil. Keep stirring. Delaney Rose stirred, watching Aunt Agnes Ann dance to Mozart. Did you know I played the cello in high school, she said. Mozart was my favorite back then, too. I take piano lessons, Delaney Rose said, but I haven't learned any Mozart. I really wanted to take ballet, Aunt Agnes said, but I ended up taking tap. She grabbed Delaney Rose again, and they did a few tap steps. Let's get these brownies in the oven, Aunt Agnes Ann said. She poured the batter into the pans and put them in the oven. She set the timer for 30 minutes. Let's go for a walk while they cook, she said. They put on their hats and coats and boots and walked around the block in the moonlight. Delaney Rose sucked in the cold air and looked at Aunt Agnes's back in the blue and green plaid coat just ahead of her. Nobody else she knew would go walking in the middle of the night. Delaney Rose loved it, the silence, the odd-shaped shadows, and the snow glittering like stardust. They got back to the kitchen with 2 minutes left on the timer. Aunt Agnes Ann opened the oven and peeked. Uh-oh, she said. She grabbed a pot holder and pulled one pan out of the oven. Delaney Rose had made a lot of brownies with her mother, and they never looked like this. Aunt Agnes Ann dumped the pan upside down on a plate. Blobs of brownies fell out. It looks like something the dog left on the porch, Aunt Agnes Ann said, and she burst out laughing. The brownies did not stick together. We forgot the eggs, Aunt Agnes Ann said. She scraped the failed brownies into the wastebasket. No sense crying over spoiled brownies. Now we get to make another batch, Aunt Agnes Ann said. They washed the brownie pans and greased them again. They broke 4 eggs into the bowl and stirred. No dancing this time. They pretended they were spaceship pilots doing a flight checkoff before takeoff. Flour, check. Cocoa, check. Sugar, check. Oil, check. Water, check. Vanilla, check. Eggs, check. Double check. They put the brownies in the oven, looked at each other, turned up the music, and danced, and danced, and danced. When they danced, they sang, "Happy birthday, dear Mozart. Happy birthday to you." The second batch was perfect. Delaney Rose tasted one before Aunt Agnes Ann wrapped them, packed them in the big canvas tote with the candles and the cocoa, cleaned the kitchen, and left. without a trace. In the morning, her family came down and ate the same breakfast they ate every day. Not one of them knew what had gone on in the kitchen the night before. If she tried to tell them, Delaney Rose thought, remembering the candles and the failed brownies and the dancing, they might not understand. They were not like Aunt Agnes Ann. Nobody in the whole world was like Aunt Agnes Ann, Delaney Rose thought, except maybe Delaney Rose.
Our final reader tonight is John Schneider, who attended Wayne State University on the GI Bill and graduated with a bachelor's degree in journalism in 1973. He has been the Lansing State Journal's daily columnist since 1987. Mr. Schneider has published two collections of his columns, plus Waiting for Home, the Richard Prangley story, which chronicles the life of a man who was wrongly institutionalized for 15 years. Please welcome John Schneider.
Oh, and thank you. Earlier this summer, I got involved in writing some columns about the internet, and particularly the internet's application at the public libraries, where kids were flocking to the libraries this summer. And it wasn't the books that was drawing them, it was the internet. And they were getting on the internet, and it wasn't Harry Potter that they were looking for. And it, as you probably know, it became a controversial issue. Parents were finding out that their kids were going to the library and doing things that they shouldn't be doing. And in fact, it led to a law. As of October 1st, libraries have to have some sort of system in place to keep kids out of pornographic sites on the internet. Terrible situation. I wrote a column about what was going on in the 1950s, and I guess it was sort of our version of the internet at the library. Name of the column written in July is Wordplay. The big dictionary at the Joy Road branch of the Detroit Public Library had all the words. All the words. Intercourse. One. Connections or dealings between persons or groups. That's not it. Two, exchange, especially of thoughts or feelings. That's not it. Three, physical sexual conduct between individuals. Ah, now we're getting somewhere. The more words we learned in the schoolyard, the more we looked up. The more we looked up, the more thrilled we became by the unflinching, straightforward, no-holds-barred pronouncements of the big dictionary. It was not, of course, the crisp prose that inspired our admiration. It was the juicy details. That's what kept us coming back. The big dictionary was uninhibited. It was unembarrassed. It handled foreplay and orgasm with the same unashamed matter-of-factness that it applied to foretell and organism. Eventually, not even Dr. Seuss could compete with the big dictionary. Individually and in groups, we tested our expanding vocabularies. The big dictionary confirmed some things and debunked others. Sometimes it was unsatisfying in its clinical approach, and sometimes its honesty took our breaths away. It was all there in black and white. You couldn't get any more explicit than that. I was talking recently to a former librarian who left the daily grind before the advent of the internet. She assured me that my pals and I were not alone in our reverence for the big dictionary. She had one at her library too, and it was infused with a certain animal magnetism also. Frequently, the librarian noticed clusters of adolescents, boys mainly, hunched over the big dictionary, giddy with their appreciation of the language. The librarian never interfered. Why should she? Aside from learning how to use the dictionary, the kids were getting the facts. They were feeding themselves precise, accurate, non-inflammatory, unprejudiced, dispassionate information. They were educating themselves. They were gaining knowledge. They were, in short, drawing from exactly the right source. What librarian could object to that? And now? Now there's the internet, which not only fails to bar any holds, but opens the wrestling match to ideas of ideas to every weapon imaginable, and some we haven't dreamed of. You've been reading lately about where that's brought us. Kids getting on the internet and plugging into hardcore pornography, bigotry, hate-mongering, and so on. Worse yet, they can wander into electronic chat rooms that are powerless to exclude sexual predators. Parents say local libraries of all places should not be high-risk environments, and that librarians have a responsibility to keep objectionable material away from their kids. Librarians, on the other hand, say they are educators, not censors, and not babysitters, and that it's the job of the parents to control what their kids see. A state law that will take effect in October will require libraries to do something. Given the limitations of various filters and library budgets, not to mention the First Amendment, that will be easier said than done. And not even the big dictionary can tell us how this one will end. Thank you. Now I'm going to read from you a passage from my book, Waiting for Home, The Richard Prangley Story. And this book is a nonfiction account of the life of Richard Prangley of Lansing, who at age 6, for no other crime other than being born prematurely, was sent to the Coldwater State Home and Training School, where he remained for 15 years. 15 years. Never once went home in the whole 15 years. He was diagnosed as a low-grade imbecile. That was the actual diagnosis on his papers. It was determined that he was not capable of learning anything. And I don't mean that he was not capable of learning trigonometry or geometry. They said that he was not capable of learning anything at all. So the first part of Richard's story was a tragedy, 15 years in what amounted to basically a human warehouse. He was called custodial care, which was at the very bottom of the rung. After 15 years, at age 21, after being deprived of any sort of normal socialization, after learning nothing, getting no academic training, learning only how to survive in an institution, at age 21, he was released. And at that point, the second part of Richard's story began, which is an extremely inspirational story, where he became a taxpaying, working, independent member of society. He now lives in Lansing, works for the Department of Community Health, just bought his own home recently, and has gone on to disprove all the assumptions about him in his younger life. Richard learned early, or figured out early, that if he wanted to get his story told, he would need to get publicity. And that's how I met him. He wandered into the State Journal one January day in 1980 with this incredible story to tell. And luckily, a newspaper is still a place, even to this day, where somebody can walk in without an appointment and with a little bit of resourcefulness can get past the front desk and talk to a reporter. Now, I have to say that 9 times out of 10, their stories prove to be nothing we can use. But now and then, a gem comes along. And in the case of Richard Prangley, that certainly happened. This is this passage from the book where I meet Richard, and he tells me his story. I don't refer to myself personally, but I'm the reporter in this passage who is the slowest one to duck. It's a chapter called A Good Fight, and it's from the book Waiting for Home. In January of 1980, Richard walked unannounced into the newsroom of the Lansing State Journal and told the receptionist that he had a good story to tell. The receptionist had heard that song more times than she could count and knew that the odds were against it. But that wasn't her problem. She relayed the information to the closest editor, who glanced over at the uncomfortable-looking man standing in the doorway. He was wearing blue jeans and a flannel shirt. He was a stocky man, about 5 feet 9 inches tall. He appeared to be hunched over. He clutched a wad of papers. His eyes darted around the room like those of an animal out of its element. Another kook walking in off the streets. Another victim of some imagined injustice. Another crackpot with an axe to grind. It was always the same. These people went to the cops, and when the cops quit listening, they came to the newsroom. Maybe the cops sent them here as a joke. That would be just like the cops. The editor took a deep breath, rolled her eyes, and asked the man to summarize his beef. Briefly, please. The man started sputtering about a mental health museum he was trying to start and something about being wrongly institutionalized when he was just a kid. Sure, and most of the people serving time are innocent. Just ask any reporter green enough to accept a collect call from a prison. But Richard was used to people trying to brush him aside. It happened all the time. He'd speak a few sentences, and the person he was speaking to would decide he wasn't normal. Then the person would start edging away, nervously looking for an escape route. Richard developed a technique for pinning people down long enough for him to demonstrate that there was more to him than his odd mannerisms and awkward speech. It was a combination of sincerity and an underdeveloped but unmistakable self-confidence that lurked beneath the surface. He wasn't necessarily sure of himself, but he was absolutely convinced his mission was essential. Richard knew the first impression he always made was a bad one. If he was ever going to get anywhere in life, he would have to get people to take a second look. Richard persisted. The more he talked, the more the editor saw a possibility that maybe there really was a story there. She looked around for a reporter. That was one of the advantages of being an editor. You could pass people like this off to reporters who were at the bottom of the newsroom pecking order. The reporters who had been enjoying the spectacle of the editor tried to extricate herself from the situation, suddenly became very busy. Some had their telephone receivers at their ears. Some were walking away quickly. One of the reporters wasn't quite quick enough. He was assigned to sit down with Richard and see if there was anything to what he was saying. Richard had come armed with records and letters, not the daunting stack that some drop-ins bring to newsrooms, just enough to lend credence to his story. The reporter took him into a conference room, offered him a chair, and asked Richard if he wanted coffee. Yes, Richard did. Double cream, double sugar. Richard started talking. His primary interest was his museum proposal and the rescue of the administration building at Coldwater, but he had spoken to enough reporters by then to know which parts of the Richard Prangley story most appealed to them. They always liked the horror stories from Coldwater, the abusive attendants, the violent residents, and they especially liked the angle that Richard never should have been in Coldwater in the first place. To Richard, the real story was the museum dream, the committee, the letters from the governor, and the imminent destruction of a historical landmark. But he knew that if he started with the bureaucratic stuff, he would lose the reporter. And besides, the museum angle might sound all the more impressive in the context of the story that preceded it. Sure enough, the reporter locked into Richard's assertion that he had been warehoused from the time he was 6 until he was 21 for no good reason. And it wasn't only Richard who was saying it. People with titles were saying it too. Richard had letters saying it. Now that was one hell of a story if it could be proven. Confirmation, it so happened, was near at hand. Dr. Alex J. Cade, an East Lansing psychologist, evaluated Richard shortly after he arrived in Lansing at the request of state officials investigating Richard's claims that he had been misdiagnosed at Coldwater. Contacted by the State Journal reporter working on the Prangley story, Cade said flatly, "In my opinion, Richard never belonged in an institution." On January 13, 1980, the State Journal ran a lengthy front page story under the headline, quote, "Man Tries to Recover Lost Time." Cade was quoted extensively, quote, "Richard is an example of the severe consequences of labeling people. He doesn't have sophisticated language skills. He doesn't have sophisticated social skills, but beneath the surface, there is considerable intelligence. He obviously has the ability to read and think abstractly. I would have to assume he always had it." Of course, it didn't take a psychologist to notice that the real Richard Prangley bore no resemblance to the boy described in the early records, that Richard, already sensing a place for himself in mental health history, had begun to accumulate, even though he couldn't read them. This was the same person doctors described as an imbecile and a moron, a person they said could not learn. Now he was a wage-earning, tax-paying citizen living a productive life outside the institution. More than that, his idea for a grand project was being taken seriously by powerful people. The State Journal also quoted Richard's fellow committee members. Mary Rave said, "Richard is supposed to be retarded, but the kind of political smarts he has is just mind-blowing." Richard's strategy paid off once more. The front-page story in the Capital City newspaper touched off another flurry of publicity. The Associated Press picked up the piece, and soon reporters were standing in line to gather up Richard's best quotes. Politicians and bureaucrats, eager to demonstrate they were friends of the underdog and enemies of injustice, found ways to become associated with Richard Prangley. Like a political candidate launching a campaign, Richard sat back and admired the fuss his visit to the State Journal had created. It was just what he needed. Thank you. I think my colleagues are going to come up here now and join me, and we'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have about life at the State Journal or writing or anything else that you might think of. If you have a question for a specific person, just say so. Yes?
This is a question for all three of you. What's your tone toward your audience, the readers of the Lansing State Journal?
Yeah, I can do that one. Friendly is what I try to be. I try and think of the reader as a real person. I try and treat them with respect always. And I try to give them the information that I would want if I were reading it. I always try and be a reader. So I view the reader with the same kind of respect and the same kind of, you know, so that friendly is the word, respectful of the reader, informal, easy to read. That's what I go for.
I agree with that. I'd like to take a conversational approach. I try not to write down to people. I try not to use words that people are going to have to look up too often. In the big dictionary, right. Never use those words. I guess that's it. Friendly, conversational. Is there anything you want to add to that, Kim?
Well, I just think... pretty much everybody has a story, you know,
yeah.
And I like to find those out. The readers are really important to us, and I like readers. that's pretty much the long and short of it for me.
We have to like them. Maria.
Well, that one they said there was too much going on. They said it didn't need Mozart, that I should take, this particular editor didn't like Mozart and said that I should take Mozart out of it and start over.
What do editors know? Right?
What do they know? That's right. the rest of them just say things like, well, this is a really nice story, but we don't think we could sell enough to justify the tremendous cost of printing children's books today. They have to be... they have to be Harry Potter in order to make money. You know, there's very little market anymore for a small children's book. It's so expensive. So,
excuse me, would that have been published in a book by itself, or would you have added other stories to it?
Now it's odd that you should say that, because most of my books I view as picture books, where they would stand on their own. But this particular character, I kind of got hooked on this little girl, and I actually have started two or three others where she goes on a cruise with her aunt, and they go to a baseball game, they go to Tiger baseball game, and you know, I had, so in other words, I was building up to now a chapter book is what I'm working on now. So,
are you three in an editorial role with the State Journal where you review, accept, or seek articles for publication?
I'm the only one who only ever came close to that, and I don't do that anymore.
We are writers, and so we write. We go out and we gather facts and we write our own material. The State Journal is not a publication that does much freelance. They don't accept too much freelance work at all. Lately, it's practically none. So.
I just wanted to say, John, are you getting sleep?
Here's a woman who follows our columns. Question is, am I getting sleep? I had written a column about what it's like having kids on summer vacation, where every night is Saturday night, except for us, who have to get up and work the next morning. And my kids are all, well, a few of them are teenagers, and so it's hard to say you need to be home at 9 o'clock on the summer night where they don't have school the next morning. So. Sometimes they're wandering in at 11 and 12 o'clock, and I don't know about you, but I still can't quite rest easy until my kids are home, you know? I don't know if I ever will until they're probably on their own. And so we had some very fitful nights all summer long where they would, I'd have them come in and report in at least when they got home, and which would, of course, wake everybody up and you know how that goes, and you can't get back to sleep, and so. But yeah, I'm sleeping much better these days. Want to talk about the puppy? Thank you for asking.
When the kids left, I went into Golden Retrievers, and so now I have two, and the second one is only 5 months old, and he's doing okay. He's getting there. We start obedience class next week, and he actually sits when you tell him to sit, and he's. Golden Retrievers, very much high energy, intelligent dog. They get bored very easily, and then they get into trouble. So it was a lot, two dogs. Right, Tom?
I've wanted to be a writer since I was a kid because of Brain Pyle. Pyle must have been your influence. Who were your influences?
Mitch Elbow. Joe Falls.
Well, I guess I didn't really have any influence. I had a 10th grade English teacher who forced me to write it was a radio play. It was an assignment. And everybody had to do it, and I had no interest in writing at the time. And, in fact, had no interest in school and just was sort of waiting to graduate from high school and get a job in the auto factories like all my uncles had done. And this English teacher forced me to write this radio play and forced me to enter it in a scholastic writing contest. And to my surprise, I won an honorable mention in this contest. And it was the first inclination that I had ever that that writing was a possibility as a way of earning a living. And once we determined that, then he was wise enough to say, okay, now that you want to write, do you plan to go and sit in the woods and try to write a novel and sell it and possibly starve to death? Or is there some other way that you can channel this? And he sort of steered me toward journalism. And from that point on, there's been never any question about what I was going to do for a career. So, and I suppose as influences go, I read a lot of columnists, but I can't really think of anyone in particular who influenced me. How about you, Kathleen?
Well, when I was a kid, I was a devotee of Dear Abby and Ann Landers. And we read them both because we were one of those unusual Michigan households that got both the Free Press and the News. You know, it was pretty much a dividing line if you're a liberal or a more conservative person. And my dad was a newspaper freak, so we got both. So I've been reading newspapers for a long time. And I just loved those advice columnists when I was little. And kind of got more interested in the rest of the newspaper from there. Then I became a fan of Hemingway and Fitzgerald, read a lot of that, said, hey, those guys made money at journalism. And it's funny that you should mention Ernie Pyle, because I've only recently discovered Ernie Pyle, and I've been reading a lot of that lately, and it is really amazing.
Well, that's interesting. The kids, of course, when they were, you know, small children and couldn't read, it wasn't a problem because they couldn't read. The real crucial period came when they got to be 11, 12, 13, that age, when all a kid wants to do is blend in and not be noticed. I mean, that's the big mission of kids that age, is not to be noticed in any way. And then I would write something about them. In fact, I remember particularly interesting battle when my older son, who was I think 13 at the time or 14, came home and asked if he could get his ear pierced, and of course I said no, you know, and his mother said that's no big deal, but you know, but anyway, I wrote a column about it, and it ran on a Sunday, and Monday came home, and there he was, and looking extremely unhappy. And I said, what happened? He said, I said, somebody mentioned the column in school. He says, everybody did, you know? I said, well, how you feel about that? He said, well, I'd prefer that you wouldn't write about me anymore. Not that I paid attention to that request, because I said, you know, this is the way I earn a living, and you live in this house, and then you enjoy the benefits of my labors. So they've been pretty understanding. A lot of times I'll be talking to people and they'll say, you're not going to write about this. So yeah, that is an occupational hazard, I guess, of knowing a columnist or being related to one. Sheila?
Yeah.
Come on, you can say something about that.
Well, the same kid who says to me that columns about me are always well received is the one who said to me when he started shaving, don't write about this. mostly my kids don't mind. I pick and choose, and even though I try to show them as human beings, but I don't really pick the really hard times that every kid has growing up. I just stay away from that.
You have to be discreet.
Right, that's right.
And, you know, I think for the most part, I have found, I don't have any kids yet, but I have found, I have a couple of cousins who are approximately my age, and we've both been through a lot together. One of them lives in Illinois, and one of them lives up north in Reed City. And every time I write anything about my cousin, an aunt who lives nearby cuts out the column and sends it to my cousin in Reed City and says, why were you doing this? When it's really the cousin in Illinois. So people, I mean, I think they, for the most part, when I've written columns that have mentioned people, they have been pretty much flattered by it. But I also, you know, if someone is really having a rough time, I'm not going to write about that in a way that they're a recognizable person, and also I have found that if I write a column that mentions my mom that I don't send to her immediately, it finds its way to her through this little network, and then she says, why didn't you want me to see that?
What are you hiding?
Exactly.
I just want to compliment you on the article of the Michigan Alumnus.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. We got a lot of feedback on that. She's referring to a piece that I wrote for the Michigan Alumnus Magazine. They did a big issue on the Life Sciences Initiative at U of M, where they're working on genome mapping. And I did a story about a variety of different families with different genetic-related diseases. And one of the stories was about my dad, who is an Alzheimer's sufferer. And, you know, that's created a lot of changes in our family. And we have learned a lot of amazing things that we never would have known otherwise. But that was a piece that was hard for me to write, and I wasn't sure I wanted to do it. And I talked to the editor for a long time about that. But thanks a lot.
I have a question for John. Are you tired of being the crusader for the loan back?
Oh no, I love that. I mean, when I was in journalism school in the early '70s. people went into journalism to make the world a better place. I mean, that was actually the motive. I mean, it was like we were almost like social workers, we felt. And that, you know, I mean, my favorite quote about newspapers is that their mission is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I really enjoy doing that. And I know a lot of people don't have a voice other than the newspaper. I mean, they can't seem to be represented by government in the way they should or they feel they should. And no, I mean, I enjoy that. I think that's the most rewarding aspect of journalism is to be able to use the power of the press to correct an injustice. I mean, I think that is the best thing that I do. So no, I don't. Yeah, thank you. There is no such thing as writer's block, and if you think that you might be prone to that, journalism probably isn't the. I mean, there is writer's block because you'll see if you go into a newsroom, you'll see reporters staring out windows and sharpening pencils that they'll never use, and getting coffee, and these are all sort of ways of greasing the wheels and getting things going or just talking. Sometimes you'll see a reporter talking a story and an editor will say, quit talking and start writing it. And well, that's just a way to sort of free up the juices. You know, you can't very well go to an editor and say, you know that 18-inch space tomorrow? It's gonna be blank. At least not for very long. What do you say about that, Cameron?
See, now I would totally agree with that. In fact, this was something that I was dealing with today. I have a story that is going to run in Sunday's paper that is about all of the fall color opportunities around the state, different, you know, how the trees turn and why people care and how much money is made off it and all that stuff. And I kind of did all these interviews on Wednesday, and then I just really didn't write it yesterday. And then this morning I said, well, you know what? Today I got to write this because in 4 hours they have to put everything together. So I started putting together the parts of the story that I knew that I had. I put together a little section with the guy talking about, a gentleman here from MSU, in fact, talking about why trees change color. And then I put together some other facts that I had, and then I put together some other stuff that I had, and then it became really obvious what was missing. And what was missing was a person who really appreciates fall color. And then I got on the phone and I found somebody who, thank God, grew up in Texas where colors never changed and thinks the color change here is absolutely the greatest thing. And I'm like, well, that's what I needed, that's what was missing. And then I put that at the top and then kind of went through and smoothed out the rest. But you know, the whole idea that you can't, the idea that you have to start at the beginning is not necessarily, it's not necessarily true. You have to start where you've got the stuff, and then it becomes clear what you need.
See, now, I would like to say that the creative process is different for every writer. I have terrible writer's block all the time, but, you know, I get through it. I sit there, and I literally sometimes, a part of my brain says, okay, today I'm going to do this. And I know I'm going to do it. But there's a part of me still, after all these years, that says, I can't do this. There's either no story, it's not good enough, I don't have enough time, the room is too hot, the room is too cold, whatever it is. And I, occasionally, this happens. It happens to everyone. And I have to start at the beginning. I am one of those people. I have to start at the beginning, and until I get something that is at least passable, I just sit there and stare at the blank computer screen, you know, but it always happens. And so that's what I know now after all these years. I mean, I've known this for a long time. It will happen. There will be a story. There will be a column. There will be something, and it'll be on time, and it'll be reasonably correct and interesting and good. And I think that is the difference. It's an expectation that you have when you're in journalism. But writer's block is a terrible thing, and it's there.
Since you write both reporting and columns, do you have the writer's block in both instances?
No, I agree with John that the personal columns are the hardest to write.
I don't think so.
Absolutely, right. When you have facts, we all have tricks, but the trick is you sit there and you say to yourself, "Why would anybody read this story?"
and then you just, that's what you write down first, and that, and then the story just, it just flows.
Plus, you're not giving up anything of yourself in a story like that.
Right.
You're not revealing anything.
Right. But, but in a personal column, you have to, the way you tell it and the words that you choose are the difference between people. People don't have to read that sometimes. I mean, that's not most of the time news they can use. You know, they read it for entertainment, they read it for enjoyment, they read it for because they're nosy. and so it has to be well written. The words have to be, the sentences have to, it's much harder. It's a much higher level exertion.
Well, the column is tough too because you really invest a lot of yourself in that. I mean, your picture is on it. People can see you in the grocery store and they know that it's you that wrote that thing that they hate or that thing that they love. And so like kind of, you know, John, for you it's every day, but for me, like on Tuesday morning, I'm like, oh, are they going to hate me or love me today? I'm not sure. And I just kind of wait for the phone to ring and see which, you know, what people are thinking. But it always evokes a response. And so, you know, you're kind of putting yourself out there to get the response.
Absolutely.
Some of the news is so awful, though, now. And I feel
well, good. That's good. Yeah, you know, a day doesn't go by that I don't hear, and I'm sure that they don't hear either. That, you know, why is there so much bad news in the paper? You know, why is it so unpleasant? And the fact is, that's just the nature of life. And you know, we wouldn't be doing our job as a newspaper if we didn't report on the unpleasant part of life as well as the pleasant part. But you know, if you can find an oasis or two in the paper of optimism and inspiration, well, that's great. You know, and we're all glad, very glad to provide that.
We like it too.
Yep. In my case, I would say that of the columns that appear in the paper, aside from the Sunday columns, 80% start out as an email or a voicemail or letters. I mean, people still send actual letters that they fold into envelopes and put stamps on. So that still happens, or faxes. 80% of the time, I would say. And often, you know, people say, how can you possibly fill that space every day? And the question isn't finding something to write about. It's what things am I going to leave out there? Because often I'll be faced with several choices, some of which can be postponed, some can't. Either I got to use them right away, or their shelf life, you know, is limited. So there's never any shortage, you know. And so I tell people that, you know, it's easy when you have, 225,000 assistant reporters out there, because that's how many people supposedly read the State Journal and call me. And you know, the most interesting calls come at 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And most of them I can't use, but it sure makes entertaining listening in the newsroom.
You mean in the morning at the Journal?
Yeah.
At your house?
No, at the Journal, yeah. Yeah.
No,
when I come in the morning and play these things, the voicemails.
That's one thing that I'm very sorry about, because I used to sit right next to John, and I got to hear the show every morning, and then they moved me to a different room. So.
When do you decide to go personal and really be vulnerable, and how do you address that? I noticed, for instance, in your the excerpt from the book, you talked about the reporter, you didn't talk about me.
Right.
You used first person.
Right. Well, in my case, it's once a week, because on Sundays, that's my personal column, and I always write about, it's always a first-person type column. The rest of the week, I write about other people. And sometimes I'll interject an opinion, or, you know, if somebody I'm trying to call hangs up on me or something, I might put that in. But generally for me, it's just once a week that I write something personal, and the rest of the week it's about other people, whereas with Kathleen and Sheila, it's a little bit different.
Right. For me, the usual column is a personal column, and that could be something that, normally I will write about trends or quirks or, you know, things that are kind of going on in my life. So that is a very personal thing. Whereas in a news story, that never creeps in for me. You know, there's kind of a line there where I don't go into the news stories. I only go into that little Tuesday space.
The idea behind using the pronouns is an attempt to expand it to more people than just that one. And that particular column got very good feedback from anybody who had ever played any kind of amateur sports. I heard from people for months about that one. And so I think, and that's the goal. The goal is to identify with people, to pick something in my life that I know inside and out, and express it in a way that people can relate to it. That's the whole purpose. It's to show that we're all united. We have this bond. We're human beings, you know, and we share something, even when we think we don't. We share something. So I stay away from names when I'm talking about my family, because I'm trying to get the reader to think of that runner as maybe their kid, or maybe them when they were in school. You know, if I could figure out a gender-neutral pronoun, I would do that, really, because the cross country, there are just as many girls who run cross country as guys. Not in our house, but, you know, I wish I could think of a way to bridge that gap, too.